I Hate the News is the weekly news bulletin from I Hate Politics podcast, a show about a human activity we love to hate. I'm Sunil Dasgupta. It's January 7th, 2025. Pepco raises rates in the new year. With the first real snow in a few years, a reminder about how much salt to use on your driveway and sidewalk. In Loudoun County, Virginia, two special elections could turn the Commonwealth's General Assembly from Democratic to Republican control. As the 2025 session of the Maryland General Assembly begins January 8th, State Senator Brian Feldman thinks the legislature might finally pass a special elections bill. Also in this new assembly session, a unique House Joint Resolution proposal to exonerate witches. Yes, you heard that right, witches from Maryland's colonial past. We'll talk with sponsor Delegate Heather Bagnall. Coming up this Friday, Maryland Senators Brian Feldman, Chair of the Education, Energy, and Environment Committee, and Jim Rosapep, Vice Chair of the Senate Budget and Taxation Committee, debate the necessity of new taxes. Stay with us.
I Hate Politics is brought to you by the Political Science Program at UMBC Shady Grove, where you'll learn a strong foundation in public policy, pre-law, and international affairs for an impactful career in a number of essential areas. Learn more at shadygrove.umbc.edu.
I Hate Politics is a podcast about our neighborhoods, workplaces, schools and streets, and our local governments as they function in diverse and democratic societies. This means our politics are messy, dirty, sometimes corrupt, with often self-serving politicians. But no matter how much we may hate politics, we are never exempt from it, even when we refuse to participate. In fact, the purpose of politics is to keep society moving precisely when we don't agree with each other, like now. Music for this episode comes from the 1920s. Song recordings and films from a century ago just entered the public domain this January. First up, Tea for Two by the Benson Orchestra of Chicago. I'm pretty sure Bollywood sampled this tune in the 1950s. The utility company that serves Washington, D.C. and its Maryland suburbs is raising its rates. In Maryland, the increase is 5%. The average residential bill will increase from $166 a month to $173. Pepco says 4% of the increase comes from a tax levied on behalf of the state's energy conservation initiative called Empower, from which the utility pays out rebates for efficient appliances, HVAC, water heaters, and high-efficiency light bulbs. The rest of the rate increase, about 1%, comes from increasing cost of energy itself. This number is expected to rise significantly as wholesale prices went up quite a bit for the next year in the regional transmission grid of which Maryland is a part. For more, check out our December 27th episode with Maryland Delegate Lorig Charkudian and West Virginia State Delegate Evan Hansen. In D.C., the average residential bill will go up from $108 a month to $114. Pepco notes that transmission and distribution costs are not going up. Distribution costs for which they are responsible increased in Maryland last year. The Maryland Office of People's Counsel says that Pepco customers paid $8.44 more a month in 2024 alone. Utility rates are approved by Maryland and D.C. Public Service Commissions and must by law cover all costs, including the cost of new investments and provide a reasonable rate of return. The first big snowstorm in a few years hit Washington, D.C. region this week, and it is time to revisit the issue of overused road salt by governments and regular folks cleaning up their driveways and sidewalks. Abby Heilman is from the Isaac Walton League, a Gaithersburg-based nonprofit that works on salt advocacy. And Carl Van Nest is a Gaithersburg resident and salt activist. This is what they said in an interview on I Hate Politics in January 2023, and it still applies.
What I see is elevated chloride levels along different streams, the Watts Branch, the Muddy Branch Stream, Seneca Creek, Cap'n John. One would expect the chloride level to be about 35 parts per million. That's kind of a natural level. We see after a snowstorm, we'll see elevated levels well over 250 parts per million for 3 months.
The EPA, they have a set secondary standard for drinking water, and that standard is 250 parts per million. After that point, or sort of at that point, depending on the individual, you can start tasting the salt in the water. There's no really good solution to, like, for road salt right now. We can't completely do away with it because we need to stay safe during the winter, but we need to be more mindful about how we use road salt. Road salt does not create traction. That's a common misconception. And then you also shouldn't really feel a crunch underfoot as you're walking with road salt. One thing that we're really trying to push this year with our campaign is to shovel early and often, because then you're going to be putting down less road salt. And then when you are ready to put down road salt, after you've shoveled quite a bit, a 12-ounce coffee mug, so your typical drinking mug, if you fill that up with salt, that is actually enough salt to use for 10 sidewalk squares or 20 feet of driveway space. And then also sweeping up that salt after you've applied it. So if the weather has sort of changed, everything's melted, you can actually sweep up that road salt and you can use it again for the next storm event. And then something that Carl and the Muddy Branch Alliance are really amazing at is reporting some of those salt spills that they're seeing too.
Meanwhile, in Washington, D.C., Monday saw a massive snowball fight in the Meridian Hill neighborhood with hundreds of participants. And the new school superintendent in Montgomery County, Thomas Taylor, broke with tradition 2 days in a row to announce school closures early rather than wait until 5 a.m. of the next morning. After several years of public loss of confidence in the Montgomery County Public Schools, MCPS, at least Facebook today is full of praise for this new approach. In Loudoun County, two special elections on January 7th could turn the Virginia Assembly from Democratic to Republican control. Democrats have controlled both houses of the legislature on a very thin majority, which has allowed them to check the power of Republican Governor Glenn Youngkin. But now, State Senator Suhas Subramaniam has been elected to Congress, and a cascade has followed. Loudoun County Delegate Kannan Srinivasan is running for Subramaniam's old Senate seat against Republican Toomey Harding. And Democrat J.J. Singh is now running for the seat Srinivasan vacated in the House of Delegates against Republican Ram Venkatachalam. But the balance in the Virginia House and Senate are really narrow. Srinivasan or Singh losing to Harding or Venkatachalam will jeopardize Democratic control, and with that, their ability to check Governor Youngkin. If it is not clear by now, it is worth noting that 3 of the 4 major party candidates in Loudoun County are Indian Americans. And that leaves out Suhas Subramaniam, who is going to Congress. Democrat Kannan Srinivasan and Republican Ram Venkatachalam are first-generation immigrants. J.J. Singh and Subramaniam himself are American-born to Indian parents. The only non-Indian-American person is Republican Tumay Harding, who is American-born to Turkish-Uzbek immigrant parents. Loudoun is one of the richest counties in the entire Washington, D.C. metropolitan area, with a median household income of over $170,000. The county is the data center capital of the world, with about 200 data centers, 40% of all of Virginia's data centers. The county has 436,000 people, of whom 20% are Indian Americans. Asian Americans are the single largest minority group in the county. Consider all of this apropos the national debate over H-1B visas, immigration, and the rising influence of an ethnic group in American politics. I should add there is a third special election in Central Virginia between Democrat Jack Trammell and Republican Luther Cyphers that could also have a critical impact. In Maryland, Senator Brian Feldman, the powerful chair of the Triple E Committee, Education, Energy, and Environment, which supervises another E issue, elections, says that the state might just get a new law that will require legislative vacancies to be filled via special elections. Currently, legislative vacancies in the state are not filled by special elections, but rather by selection by the county party committees, Democrats for Democratic health seats and Republicans for the Republican health seats. A significant number of the legislature has entered the assembly in this way, and the county party committees have become a stepping stone in the process. In many cases, members have picked themselves or one of their own. All of this has caused heartache for those left out. Here is Brian Feldman.
As recently as last night, we yet again have a central committee appointing a new state senator to District 30 for this Congresswoman Elfra's seat. We have Senator Jill Carter has resigned, and we're going to have to fill that seat. There may be other shoes to drop. I think the time's come. Last session, we passed out of the state Senate, out of my committee and the full Senate, almost unanimously, a special elections bill that takes it away from central committees, the legislative vacancy issue, and puts it in the hands of voters. And it's stalled in the House. I think some of the opposition on the House side has indicated that they now will support the proposal. So I'm cautiously optimistic that finally, we will pass a special elections bill, which will then put it on the ballot in 2026, as it requires a constitutional change. And from that point forward, we won't be relying on central committees to fill legislative vacancies. The voters of our state will do so. So I'm hoping we get that one done this session.
Also, in the 2025 Maryland General Assembly session, Delegate Heather Bagnall of District 33 in Anne Arundel County has proposed a unique House resolution to exonerate and apologize to at least seven individuals accused of being witches in Maryland during the colonial period. Here is Delegate Bagnall.
I can tell you their names and I can tell you the outcome of the allegations. Mary Lee, Elizabeth Bennett, John Cowman, Rebecca Fowler, Hannah Edwards, Virtue Viol, and Mal Dyer. Now, Mal Dyer is the one that probably people are most familiar with. She was accused by locals of witchcraft. She was driven out of her home, which was burned, and she died of exposure. It was a very cold night. If you're familiar with the Blair Witch was actually modeled after Mal Dyer. The Blair Witch was obviously not a true story, but Mal Dyer was a true figure. She lived in Western Maryland.
So usually accusations are against women, but you said there's one man.
John Cowman. He was actually convicted of witchcraft, and he was sentenced to death. But his sentence was commuted to labor. He became an indentured servant. Mary Lee, she was en route to Maryland, and she was actually hung at sea on the Charity of London. Elizabeth Bennett was accused, but she was not indicted. Rebecca Fowler was accused, and she was actually hung. Hannah Edwards was accused and indicted and tried, but was acquitted. And the last person that we know of to be tried for witchcraft in Maryland was Virtue Veal, and she was acquitted in 1712. So that is the last known witch trial in Maryland. And so we don't, you know, it's been 400 years. So we don't know a lot about these folks, but we are learning more every day.
So it is an incomplete history, obviously. Is it your expectation that there are many more?
I would expect that there are more that were accused, but were not formally tried.
Do you understand why there were acquittals versus why somebody was hung?
From what I understand, it was mostly about community advocacy.
Do you think there are class differences there? So if you were upper class, that the community did support, and then if you were not, then the community did not support?
Absolutely. When we look at witch trials historically, and not just in Maryland, we definitely see that class distinction. We also see that gender divide.
Do we know anything about witchcraft accusations across the color line?
Some of the supporting documentation that I have for this resolution speaks to that. Midwifery was primarily a practice of women of color, and that there wasn't a lot of documentation. And we've seen that in Maryland with other social justice reforms. We are looking at our own history right here in District 33. We have a reconciliation project at the Crownsville Hospital Memorial Park, where we have had archivists that have spent the last 20 years identifying the unmarked graves of residents who died at the hospital. Their graves were only marked with numbers.
Why now? Why are you doing this now? What is the impetus for it?
This was brought to me by a colleague of mine, because it's part of a national effort. It started in New England with Connecticut and Massachusetts. Obviously, they have the most well-known witch trials because people should not be on record historically accused or acquitted of a crime that they never should have been accused of in the first place. When I look at things like the SB 8 in Texas, which deputized private citizens to go after people who were aiding women seeking abortion care. And all of the impetus is on the accused to disprove their assistance. I feel like that we need to look at our history and reconcile our history.
Your resolution does offer a historical apology. Do you think these kinds of apologies should be made in other areas? For example, you know, with respect to slavery or indentured servant?
I don't want to conflate anything, but I think it's very important to make these formal apologies and to acknowledge our history. Because when we don't, then we have a tendency to rewrite it. When we don't reconcile the mistakes that we've made, when we don't try and make amends, then we are doomed to repeat those mistakes because we teach the next generation that they weren't mistakes.
I can't let you go without answering the political science question. What is the difference between a bill that becomes a law and a House joint resolution?
A bill that becomes a law is binding. A House resolution is not binding. It's an acknowledgement of the will of the body. We can't change the law to make right something that happened 400 years ago. But we can use our voice to say this was wrong and it shouldn't have happened.
Heather Bagnall, thank you for taking the time. Good luck in the session.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's all for this episode. Be sure to check out our feature interview series that come out Friday mornings. Coming up this Friday, Maryland Senators Brian Feldman, Chair of the Education, Energy, and Environment Committee, and Jim Rosapep, Vice Chair of the Budget and Taxation Committee. I Hate Politics is produced by me, Sunil Dasgupta, with support from University of Maryland, Baltimore County. I direct UMBC's political science program at the universities at Shady Grove in Montgomery County, where, among other things, we explore and learn about politics, government, and society close to home. Music for this episode comes from the newly in public domain tunes from the 1920s. We heard the Paul Whiteman Band, their work, I Will See You in My Dreams, and Carl Fenton's Limehouse Blues. Those were within the episode. And now we go out with Jan Garber with the number I Want to Be Happy. Who can argue with that? Usually we feature local music on the show. If you want to share your music on the podcast or know someone else who might want to, please email us at producer@ihppod.org. See you next time. Thank you.